Ask the experimenters why they experiment on animals. And the answer is, because the animals are like us. Ask the experimenters, why is it morally okay to experiment on animals? And the answer is, because the animals are not like us. Animal experimentation rests on logical contradiction. Charles R. Magle, philosopher and professor. Good evening. My name is Jamie Delaney, and this is the 25th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast.
I'm a plant-based cardiologist living in Southwest Florida. I'm also an endurance athlete. I bring this podcast to listeners to help enlighten them on a plant-based diet, both the health benefits as well as the environmental benefits and the benefits for all animal kind. Tonight, I have a special guest, Gene Bauer. Gene has a new book called Living the Farm Sanctuary Life. He's a very interesting guy. I first heard him interviewed in a debate on farming and sustainability, very eloquent speaker. Gene became vegetarian and vegan way back in 1995. He actually got his degree in agricultural economics. He wanted to be knowledgeable in the area of factory farming in order to be a better rights or better animal activist. This book is extremely well written. It's the photography is certainly that of a coffee table book. The pictures are exquisite. The stories are really great. I wanted to share with you a few excerpts. He breaks it down into, you know, what he breaks it down into stories about animals as well as the health benefits from eating plant-based, the how-tos of eating plant-based, as well as the environmental impacts of factory farming. But, you know, one of the things that he has is eight plants with unexpected health benefits, which is a nice little chart. One, avocados may help prevent birth defects. They are high in folate, which is an important B vitamin that combats a common neural tube defect in women that have low folate levels. Number two, beans can benefit people with diabetes. They're very nutritious and low on the glycemic scale. They don't cause a blood sugar spike. Flax seeds, number three, improve women's health. They reduce the risk of breast cancer by metabolizing estrogen and can also decrease hot flashes. Flax can also help regulate the menstrual cycle. Number four, kale is a great detoxifying agent. It's high in fiber and sulfur and supports a healthy liver. Number five, Swiss chard contains more vitamins and antioxidants than nearly any other plant. It includes high levels of omega-3 fatty acids, B vitamins, copper, sodium, potassium, iron, manganese, calcium, and phosphorus, as well as vitamins A, C, and K. It's very helpful in the prevention of colon and prostate cancer. Six is beets. It improves sexual vitality. There's high levels of boron, which is linked to the production of human sex hormones. Seven, celery can relieve joint pain, and it's a natural anti-inflammatory agent. Number eight is arugula, again, loaded with nutrients and is a performance enhancer for athletes without any negative side effects. So those are eight fun-filled facts just on one page of the book. He also talks about eggs. You know, they've received a lot of press lately that maybe an egg a day is okay. Of course, that was sponsored by the Egg Board, but even though it may not have that much fat, it's mainly high in cholesterol, and as we know, fat drives cholesterol more than cholesterol drives, the intake of fat drives cholesterol production to a greater degree than the intake of cholesterol in most people. However, eggs are very high in protein, which also create an acidic environment that can promote the division of cancer cells. And there, he cites a 20-year study published by the Journal of American Medical Association that found women who consumed three or more eggs that consumed eggs 3 or more days a week were 3 times more likely to die of ovarian cancer than women who consumed less than one egg weekly. And even, of course, egg whites, you know, people always say that they're so healthy, but again, they're very highly protein concentrated, which is the problem, again, in cancer, that animal protein, such as eggs and animal flesh, are strongly linked to inflammation and the increased risk of cancer. So, you know, multiple things are cited as far as the health benefits of being plant-based. There's some really great stories about animals that they've rescued on the farm. He started by, he was doing some research on factory farming, and they would find animals that were left to die, and they started to rescue them. And one thing led to another, as you'll soon hear about in the interview. Gene is also an endurance athlete. He's done several triathlons and marathons. I think he's slated to run the New York City Marathon. So again, you know, people say, where are you going to get your protein? How are you going to cover? If you've seen pictures of Gene Bauer, he's a very fit individual and certainly does quite well in the field of endurance athletes, or athletics, sorry. Gene is anything but an angry vegan. Oftentimes, animal rights activists get unfairly labeled as being angry or in your face. He is anything but that. He's an extremely compassionate individual. He believes in meeting people where they are. He believes in positive association with changing your food choices. He believes in showing the compassion for animals and farm animals as an example, or being a beacon to what it's like to raise these farm animals in a humane situation. Even the veterinarians that, you know, come and visit the farm find it a very calming, comforting environment. So I think you'll find the interview quite pleasant and intriguing. And again, I would urge you to check out his website, farmsanctuary.org. There's ways that you can donate, even adopt a cow or a pig or a turkey, but you can also donate to the site. His book is listed there as well. There are ways to go visit the Farm Sanctuary, both located in upstate New York and in California. So do check out his site, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome, Gene Bauer. Gene is one of the founders of the Farm Sanctuary. I'll let him fill you in on their locations and how they work. He most recently has released a book along with Gene Stone called Living the Farm Sanctuary Life. I think it should be on everybody's coffee table and maybe in the kitchen too, because the recipes are wonderful, the photography is wonderful, and the message is even more beautiful. So welcome, Gene.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
So Gene, I first heard you speak in a debate about sustainable farming with Mr. Pollen on it, and another guy that did, I think a Virginia farm that did, you know, crop rotating with animals and things like that. And it was basically on, you know, the best way for our food to be sustainable and how best to take care of us. So tell me a little bit about how you got started in all this, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, well, I went vegan in 1985 after learning about the factory farming industry and recognizing that I could live and get everything I needed nutritionally from eating plants and no animals. Before that, I had heard about factory farming. My grandmother told me about how veal calves were mistreated, so I swore off veal in high school. But I didn't go vegan until I learned more about just how horrible this industry was to animals and the impacts on the planet, and that I had a choice. You know, I grew up believing that I had to eat meat, for protein and for nutrients. But once I realized that I didn't, and I didn't need to drink cow's milk or eat eggs either, going vegan was very easy for me.
So was your grandmother vegan?
No, she wasn't.
Just didn't eat veal.
She was just like an animal lover. She had, you know, cats. She took care of cats in the neighborhood. So she was just an animal person, and she's the one that kind of got me aware of the whole factory farming issue. And Farm Sanctuary started, you know, I co-founded it in 1986 to take on this issue that wasn't really getting a lot of attention. Most people grow up eating in a certain way, and, you know, we eat meat, milk, and eggs in this country without really thinking about it, and that was my experience. And I believe that if people knew that they had the choice not to eat those products, or at least to eat fewer of them, and recognize that, you know, this was an industry, this factory farming industry was causing so much harm, I think most people would rather make a change. And so Farm Sanctuary started to expose the cruelty of factory farming, to raise awareness, to encourage citizens to become more mindful about their food choices, and ultimately to live in a way that is aligned with their own values. Most people are humane. Most people don't like cruelty. But most people are also unwittingly supporting an abusive system by buying into the meat, milk, and eggs and supporting factory farming.
So tell me my audience, how do you come about getting the animals?
Well, Farm Sanctuary started by doing investigations. And we would find living animals literally thrown in trash cans or living animals thrown on piles of dead animals. So we started rescuing them and caring for them, and so it evolved out of that. And pretty soon we realized we needed more space, because at the time we were operating out of a row house in Wilmington, Delaware, and a farmer in Pennsylvania let us use a couple of acres as well, but we needed more space. So we were able to acquire a 175-acre farm in Watkinsville, New York, which we still operate as Farm Sanctuary, and we encourage people to come visit and get to know the animals, get to meet cows and pigs and turkeys and chickens and lambs and goats. And then we also have two farms now in California where we take care of these animals who have been rescued from factory farms. And the animals essentially are ambassadors. You know, there's no way that Farm Sanctuary or any sanctuary is going to be able to rescue the literally billions of animals who need homes. So we rescue the ones we can, and we take care of them. And at Farm Sanctuary, they're our friends, not our food. And we model a different kind of relationship where, you know, these animals get to be themselves. Cows get to go out and graze. Pigs get to go out and root in the mud. And they're treated kindly by people. So pigs, when they see us coming up, they're happy because it might mean a belly rub, which is very different than what they experienced prior to coming to Farm Sanctuary. And we just want people to recognize that these are living, feeling creatures who are not very different than cats and dogs. They have relationships with each other and with us. They have memories, and they want to enjoy life just like us. And living at Farm Sanctuary, we're inspired by these animals, and it's a very peaceful place. The animals are not afraid of us. They don't have to be afraid of us. And you contrast that with the way animals are treated on factory farms, and it's like night and day. You know, on the factory farms, they're put in small cages where they can't move, where they're clanking against the bars of their crates, literally screaming to get out. And the animals suffer horribly, and I would also say the people who work in those places suffer and absorb the stress and the ugliness of the place. You know, plus, the air is very thick with toxic fumes from all the manure that is produced. So it's just a very dirty, violent place. And that's bad for everybody. Farm Sanctuary is a peaceful place, a place of transformation, where animals who have been mistreated are able to come and heal, both physically, because we treat them for various medical conditions, but also emotionally, as they learn to trust us and feel safe. And then they begin to flourish and enjoy their lives. It's a beautiful thing to see.
You know, the other thing that is so amazing, you know, with animals, and, you know, I see it with my dogs, but obviously the stories that are in your book, you know, about the run pig and, you know, the Susie, the cow, or no, it's not Susie as a person, Larry's a cow. You know, they're so forgiving, you know, after such mistreatment, you know, they're able to forgive and, you know, build relationships. And you know, so many things we take for granted, and there's so many things we can learn from them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's, you know, it's good for them, and it's also good for us.
I was surprised when I was reading the story about the pig, the runt. I can't remember his name, but you know, it was playing out like a Disney movie, you know. And I was hoping for, you know, I mean, it ended up happy at the end, but I was hoping it would be better for the runt. But it is. I think, you know, again, the animals can bring out compassion and wake people up if just given the opportunity.
Exactly, and it requires people though to pay attention and to listen. And to have empathy and to recognize that when we look into the eyes of one of these animals, that there is somebody there. You know, there's somebody, not something, as we like to say.
Yeah, it's really, really, really good stories. And, you know, the other part about the book that, you know, I mean, so you have the animal stories, and then you kind of take it through the whole, you know, it's kind of a what you need to know book about why and how to become plant-based. Certainly the stories are wake-up calls, but you delve with, you know, what to have in your kitchen, the health benefits. You know, I thought they were very, very good. And, you know, also even clothes. You know, people, I think, when you first go plant-based, you know, or you go vegan, the food is one thing, and then it becomes, you know, that part of it. So tell me, how did you kind of go about all this? I guess you've been a vegan long enough that you kind of addressed all the issues, but tell me a little bit about the layout of the book.
Yeah, well, I've been a vegan since 1985, and the way the book is laid out is in the first section, it talks about the tenets of living the farm sanctuary life, things like living in alignment with your values, because most people are humane, but most of us grow up eating animal foods from factory farms, which are not humane, so there's this disconnect and this dissonance between our values and our behaviors. And so if we align our values and our behaviors, that is tenet number one, which is really kind of flows throughout all the other tenets and is really central to the whole idea. Second tenet is to have a mindful relationship with other animals, to be respectful and to recognize that they're living creatures. And, you know, people who live with cats and dogs and have companion animals have lower stress and their lives are improved. So when we have a mindful relationship with other animals, it helps us too, and we've seen that at Farm Sanctuary. Third tenet is to have a mindful relationship with our food and to recognize that our food choices matter and there are consequences to eating bad food, you know, fast food and processed food and junk. And there are consequences as well, positive ones, to eating whole plant foods. So being mindful about our food and also knowing where it comes from. The third tenet is to eat plants for our own health and well-being. And as a doctor, I'm sure you've seen the results of eating well or not eating well. So eating plant-based whole foods helps us improve our personal health. And then the final tenet is to eat plants for the well-being of the planet. Most people don't really think so much about the fact that producing meat, milk, and eggs requires an enormous amount of resources. We could feed something like 10 times more people if we ate plant foods instead of animal foods. You know, to produce animal foods, you have to grow enormous quantities of crops that are then harvested and fed to animals. If we ate those crops directly, we would save a lot of energy, we would save a lot of resources, and frankly, be healthier. So the United Nations even put out a report a few years ago called Livestock's Long Shadow. And that report talks about how animal agriculture is one of the top contributors to the most serious environmental problems facing our planet, including climate change. In fact, animal agriculture contributes more to climate change than the entire transportation industry. So this is an issue that affects us all in many ways, very personally. The way we eat affects our bodies and the cells of our bodies. And it also affects our planet. And there's nothing else I'm aware of that has such wide-ranging and profound consequences as our food choices. So it's important for us to think about the way we eat. And ultimately, if we eat in a way that's aligned with our values and aligned with our interests, we will see a revolution in our food system.
Talk to me a little bit about, you know, there's the paleo movement and Yeah, you know, I mean, just people are always really quick to say, oh, but my chicken is free range and all my cows are grass. Of course, the best one I like is the grass-fed butter. And it's like, I've never seen butter eat, but, you know, it seems to be, you know, I guess a justification for what they really know. But, you know, address, you know, is that, you know, the what free range really isn't and, you know.
Yeah. Well, people, I think, do not like factory farming, and there's widespread mainstream opposition to factory farming where animals are put in small cages where they can barely move. So what has happened is that a number of food producers and retailers are now starting to sell products labeled as free-range or organic. And those labels tend to sound a lot better than they are. In the case of free-range, for example, it only requires that animals have access to the outdoors, but it doesn't say how much space they need or how much access to the outdoors they need. So what that could mean, and often does mean, is you have animals confined by the thousands in a warehouse with a small door that goes out to a little porch area, and that's considered access to the outdoors. But that's not what people think of when they think free range. So a lot of these labels are misleading, and in fact, free-range and organic products come from factory farms still. So that's something people need to be aware of. The only way to really know how animals are being treated on the farms is to actually visit them and see what's going on. I actually visited Joel Salatin's farm called Polyface in Virginia, and he has this reputation as being a really down-to-earth, humane farmer. Well, I saw some pretty inhumane conditions at that farm. So it's important to visit and see what's going on before we assume that the animals are treated very well.
Well, and then when we're driving, you know, in Florida, there's a fair amount of cattle ranches, but those are just part of the story. It's either where they're, you know, they don't spend, I mean, you see cows out in the grass, but I would guess that's a limited part of their life, and they're finished in these feedlots and everything else.
That is correct. And actually, when you look at all the animals that are exploited for food in the U.S., cattle raised for beef have it the least bad, I would say. So, you know, as you mentioned, you're driving through the countryside, you'll see cattle out on the range. That is the first part of the production cycle. From there, they will go to a feedlot in most cases. And then from the feedlot, they obviously go to the slaughterhouse. So what people see is not representative of what most farm animals experience. And when we're talking about numbers of animals, the vast majority who are raised and slaughtered in the U.S. are the chickens who are raised for meat. And these birds have been genetically manipulated to grow twice as big and twice as fast as normal. They're confined in these massive warehouses by the tens of thousands. And they never go outside, and they're constantly breathing in the toxic fumes from their feces. And, you know, sometimes they die of heart attacks because they're growing so fast and so large that their hearts and lungs cannot support that sort of growth rate. So they die of heart attacks just a couple weeks old. So that's the majority of the animals raised in the U.S. are chickens, and that's how they live.
Yeah, I mean, they never get a chance. It's and I think, and that's the other side from the health standpoint. We've somehow been able to, I guess, through Tyson and, you know, advertisements, you know, eat chicken, it's much more healthy, which in reality, it's not more healthy even, which has caused this industry to grow even more and more out of control.
Exactly. And that's been the story, you know, that's been told that eating chicken is healthy, when in fact it isn't, and when in fact we can do very well without eating any animal foods, including chicken flesh. So, but yeah, there's been a shift in recent years towards more chickens, and that has actually caused the number of animals slaughtered in the U.S. to go up because chickens are much smaller than cows, and you need to kill a lot more chickens in order to get 100 pounds of meat, for example. So we encourage people just to step back, think about the way they're eating, look at the consequences of their food choices, and then ask themselves what makes sense and what do they feel good about. And you know, if we can live well without causing harm and without killing other animals, why wouldn't we? And that's the question we ask people to consider. You know, if we can live well without causing harm, why wouldn't we?
Yeah, it seems to make perfect sense. You know, I in dealing with patients that, you know, they come to my office not really expecting a plant-based lecture. They expect a pill or a procedure or to be told you're okay. And I start, you know, my spiel on, you know, what a plant-based diet is and how to go about it. And if I, you know, if I can get them thinking about it, and we have, you know, we have books and cookbooks around the office. I actually want to put some of your books in the office as well, because I think that brings, because I think that for people to stay plant-based for a health reason, you know, typically it's like any other diet. You know, they may go plant-based for a while, feel good, skinny up, and then slowly drift back into their old ways, you know, for whatever reason. But I think if they can start to identify with where their food comes from and, you know, the impact of factory farming, that, you know, they, you know, both environmental reasons and for the animals, you know, maybe I think we have a better chance of keeping people plant-based.
I think that's absolutely right. People are complex, and we are motivated and influenced by various things. And, you know, health is one of them. Ethics is one of them. Feeling good is one of them. Feeling good about ourselves and our identity is another one. Wanting to be responsible and not destroying our planet through our irresponsible choices, including food choices. So there's a lot of reasons why it makes sense to go towards eating plants instead of animals. And we encourage people to look at all of these, the health, the ethical, the social justice, because factory farms are terrible for rural communities. They push small farms out of business and hurt rural economies and cause property values to go down with all the pollution and so on. So this is an industry that most people really don't like when they get to understand what it looks like. And so what is happening now is agribusiness is trying to pass these laws in various states. They're called ag-gag laws, to make it more difficult to conduct undercover investigations to expose the cruelties and the abuses of these factory farms. So this is an industry that is so bad, they're trying to prevent people from seeing what they're doing.
Yeah, I, you know, the runoff in North Carolina, I forget the book, but as far as, you know, all the people becoming ill in the area, you know, it's just incredible. And they, again, like you say, I think we all identify with the farmers of yesteryear, perhaps, and maybe that's why some people hold on to it, because they remember the mom and pop farms, and they have, like you say, they have no idea of how this actually goes. I heard a talk about, you know, that Tyson is really, it's the majority of poultry Tyson is involved in, and the factory, they basically, the poor farmer gets these gigantic loans to warehouse these chickens in the way that Tyson wants, and Tyson basically, you know, collects the chickens and does the good part where the farmer does the dirty work, and then they usually go belly up on their loans, and the banks are still supported, so it's just like a vicious cycle that, you know, another farmer gets a terrible loan that they can't repay, and Tyson keeps making, you know, going on.
You're absolutely right. These small farmers become sort of like indentured servants on their own land. They take out a loan to construct a building that meets Tyson's specifications. They have to do everything according to Tyson's rules. And they end up with property that is polluted, and they end up having to dispose of lots and lots of dead birds in addition to the manure. So their property is hurt as a result of this arrangement. But in many cases, people are desperate. They don't think they have any other options. And it's a very sad thing to see.
The health of your animals at Farm Sanctuary, I would guess, when they're not in overcrowded conditions, they don't get sick as often as if they're all stacked up on top of each other.
Absolutely. Having open spaces is very good for them. Although they have been, you know, all farm animals have been genetically bred for certain production-related traits. And they are killed very young. You know, pigs, for example, are usually killed at 6 months old.
Oh my.
In the industry. You know, but at Farm Sanctuary, they get to live many years. So we're actually learning a lot about these animals and about some of the ailments they have, because the industry has bred them to grow fast and to grow large, but not for them to be healthy necessarily.
Well, and that brings up my next you know, in dealing with local veterinarians, you know, here around myself, you know, in my area in Florida, in discussion, you know, I'm plant-based and, you know, I made my own dog food, and they're pretty much plant-based. And, you know, they really argue with me over some of that, you know, that regular old dog, you know, I guess it shocks me that the veterinarians are not all plant-based or vegan. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, in vet school, sometimes people become hardened and indoctrinated to accept certain ideas. You know, I got a master's degree from Cornell in agricultural economics, and I took a number of animal science classes with veterinary students. And it was interesting to see the sort of desensitization that occurs in these classes. And I remember one of them where we were in the pig barn at Cornell, and there were a couple of mother pigs in these crates with their babies. They were farrowing crates. So there was some space for the mother, a little space on the side for the piglets. And the teacher was showing the students routine farming procedures such as cutting off the tails of the piglets, castrating the male piglets, notching the ears of the piglets. You know, all of this done without any painkillers. And the pigs were screaming and bleeding and clearly in pain. And at first, the students in the class looked at this and they recoiled. They didn't like it. It was obviously painful, and they were squeamish about it. But the teacher said, "Who wants to try this?" And none of the students stepped forward, but eventually the teacher called on one who tried his hand at these mutilations. Then a second student stepped forward to do it. And each time a new student stepped forward to engage in these harmful practices, the initial resistance drained away, and bad was becoming normal. And that's what happens with vet students, I think, is they go in with certain ideals, but there are courses and there's a culture around the veterinary profession that has historically been pretty unfriendly to animals. That is happily starting to change. Many vet students now are female, and there has been some evolution in the veterinary profession. There's still a long way to go, but there are some good signs of change.
And the vets that come out to Farm Sanctuary, what's their take on this? What's their take on the farm?
Well, you know, most of them are pretty happy to be able to work with animals in a positive situation and to be able to actually practice their medicine and practice as veterinarians. You know, in most situations with farm animals, it's an economic equation. And if the animal's not worth a certain amount, they're not going to spend that money on a veterinarian. And they'll sometimes just write them off as dead and then do a necropsy. So the veterinarians enjoy working with us. It gives them a chance to hone their skills and actually to learn things, because it's very rare for farm animals to be given the sort of attention and consideration in veterinary care that they receive at Farm Sanctuary.
Yeah, I would think. And do you know, I mean, have you had any, you know, vets become vegan over experience in time there?
Well, we've had a number of interns come through Farm Sanctuary who have become veterinarians, and a number of friends of ours are vegan veterinarians. But many of the veterinarians we work with work on other farms too. They're farm vets in that farm world. And I would say some have started eating less animal products, but I don't know of any that have become completely vegan yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, keep trying.
We absolutely will, yes.
Yeah, I would think, you know, it'd be tough to go back, you know, to the factory farm and all the antibiotics and the steroids. I mean, it seemed to me you'd see the disconnect pretty quickly, you know, how healthy and happy the animals are, you know, at the sanctuary versus the conditions that they're living in. I would think that would get to you as a vet pretty quick.
You would think, you know, but
again, yeah,
that's kind of close their eyes and close their hearts. And you know, they make money when they're working for these factory farms and put the animals on a lot of drugs. That's another thing. It's another huge problem with animal agriculture now is the intensive use of antibiotics. And so, yeah, unfortunately, some veterinarians just go along with that system and they profit from it. And so that's kind of an incentive to do so. But there's change, and students now in veterinary schools don't like what they're seeing on these factory farms, and the agribusiness is having a difficulty getting veterinarians to do it. So they're having to pay more, which is an incentive. So it's an ongoing process. It's a social economic evolution underway.
What was your take on McDonald's coming out and saying that they're going to request chicken that our only need to be on antibiotics, as I think the way it really was stated, but it came out that, you know, it was kind of swayed that they're going to be antibiotic-free chickens.
Well, you know, it shows that there's more concern about this on the part of the public, and that food retailers are now starting to make some small moves. It's certainly not anything close to enough, but it begins a process. And there's a and the process begins with a recognition that there's a problem. So that's the good part about it. A lot more needs to be changed than they're proposing, but it's a step.
Yeah, I guess the awareness with McDonald's doing that might be a really good thing, because, you know, one question leads to another, perhaps.
Exactly. It begins a discussion. And, you know, one of the big problems over the years is that there has not been a discussion. And people just don't think about their food, and they don't think about how the animals are treated and the antibiotics and so on. So when McDonald's makes an announcement like that, it gets people thinking and discussing and hopefully looking more closely. And that creates change.
I'm originally from West Virginia, and my daughter's in school there, and I was up visiting, and we went to a restaurant, and she was all excited, she's vegan, and she wanted to take me to this restaurant. They have wraps with tofu and broccoli and barley and things like that, and, you know, it's like, for West Virginia, that is a big deal to offer that, you know. And then, of course, they brought the guacamole out that was made with sour cream and a few avocados, which I understand the cost containment of all that kind of stuff. But it's a start. You know, when I was in school, there was, you know, maybe one restaurant that had vegetarian-leaning options. But so, you know, if a college town in West Virginia can offer a vegan fare, it's certainly coming around.
Yes, absolutely. You know, bit by bit, and all over the country. You know, it's amazing to see how much vegan food is becoming available all over the place now.
Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, even Chili's has a bean burger now, which, you know, that was, you know, you pretty much could have had to write those places off, and so they're, you know, they're having some options. Let me change
Beautiful.
A little bit. So when did you start doing triathlon?
I started doing triathlon about 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, up until then, I had been a runner, played a lot of Ultimate Frisbee, which I still love when I get a chance to play. But lately I've been doing triathlons, and I've done several marathons.
And do you see any view into the future as far as maybe hooking these two up and starting to promote a vegan lifestyle in the endurance community?
Absolutely. In fact, whenever I've done these races, I'm quick to talk to people about the fact that I'm plant-based. I sometimes wear my No Meat Athlete shirt or Farm Sanctuary shirt during marathons or triathlons. There definitely is a growing number of athletes who are plant-based who are talking about the benefits of plant-based nutrition. And I think that's one of the reasons that our movement is really growing and expanding, is that we're touching into these other related areas. Athletics, for example, which is connected to health, obviously, and then athletic performance, which is enhanced with plant-based foods. Also, the culinary world is becoming more interested in plant-based, and there's some incredible vegan foods that are delicious that are now being produced and prepared. So there's these great ongoing developments that are reaching more and more people with a positive vegan plant-based message. But yes, absolutely, I'm using my marathons and triathlons to talk up the benefits of plant-based eating. And I did an Ironman, so that's something that a lot of people sort of scratch their head and wonder, how can a vegan do that? But vegans can do a lot of things.
Yes, I've done two. And that at Ironman Chattanooga, it was kind of funny because they were sponsored by Little Debbie. But, you know, so it's like, I got to put the, you know, it's like, please don't put that on the you know, it's like, please, I hope my free shirt doesn't say Little Debbie on it. And we were driving up there and my boyfriend was, we were pulling up the nutrition facts. He said, surely there's got to be one plant-based Little Debbie product, you know, and we were pulling up the ingredients on everything. And it's like, no, I'm sorry, you know, you're out of luck. But they did have the chia pods at the expo, which I thought was pretty cool.
So, excellent, yeah. So that's a positive step. But you know, I've also seen that at these triathlons, you often have the dairy industry, who's very, very invested in and well-represented in promoting cow's milk as a recovery drink even, which is crazy. But it's great that, you know, there's vegan athletes like you out there, you know, talking to some, and also being a doctor. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, well, I'm trying. It, you know, I'm still learning approaches. You know, that was one question I was going to ask you. So, you know, you get enough pushback, you know, to take, you know, to step into somebody's dietary menu. But when you start talking, how do you approach, you know, the subject? I guess, do people ask you, or do you, you know, how does it come up with you? How do you start that dialogue?
You know, It's challenging. You have to be gentle and understand that food is very emotional, and sometimes people will react in unpredictable ways. You know, I think one of the best approaches is to just be very generous and bring vegan food and share vegan food whenever and wherever you can. So if there's a potluck, bring vegan food. If there's a party or a get-together with people, bring vegan food. Even if somebody's preparing the meal, you know, talk to them beforehand, but just recognize that a lot of times folks don't know how to make vegan food, and if they know a vegan is coming, they're going to be worried about preparing the proper food, and so just offering to bring the food or work with them and cook with them and just give people support is one of the most important things. And, you know, again, this is emotional, so sometimes people might react in a way where they feel they're being attacked. We just need to understand that, you know, people are afraid of change. People don't want to see themselves as bad. And look for the common ground. Look for the common interest in eating tasty food, for example. And that's where bringing the food is so important. Or talk about the abuses of factory farming, how calves are put in small veal crates or chickens in small cages for egg production. And find the common ground and build from there. I think that's really the best advice.
Very good. I heard a psychologist being interviewed that dealt with food addiction, and she brought up a very interesting point in that, you know, people's food addictions and food choices as an adult tend to go back to their childhood and happy times, or, you know, seeking out things that maybe they were missing as a child that they held on to. You know, she gave the example that she was the youngest child, and her mother worked in a restaurant and cooked for everybody else, but she was kind of left with a nanny, and she didn't really, wasn't around her mother, and she associated this for having like this big dairy, you know, basically a dairy addiction, ice cream addiction, and, you know, she kind of associated it with her mother, and she even went one step further with Howard Jacobson and talked about his chocolate addiction, and, you know, back when his mother, you know, it was like a special moment with he and his mother, and, you know, I've had some patients, and I, you know, you start to think about it, and I think that probably does play a role and does make this conversion so much harder when people tie food to, you know, happy memories, sad memories, the way they grew up, certain family members, you know, their ethnic heritage. It becomes very difficult.
Absolutely. No, it's emotional. Food, you know, we are emotional animals. As much as humans like to look at ourselves and say we're rational animals and, you know, we really are rationalizing animals, and we rationalize things if we don't feel very good about them. So, you know, we rationalize eating animals, for example, saying, well, we've always done it, or we need to do it for nutrients, or, you know, there's all these rationalizations. But at the end of the day, I think essentially we are emotional, and we want to do things that feel good and feel right. And as you say, that sort of ties back to childhood memories and associations with certain food habits. But we can create new associations, positive ones, with new food habits that are healthier and better for us and better for the planet. So, but it's a process, and just recognizing that food is emotional is, I think, an important step.
I heard a lecture by Will Tuttle not too long ago, and he was talking about the stages of becoming a vegan. You know, and the first one is you can't, you know, you just read every book you have, can get a hold of, and you're listening to everything you can. And then the second part, you want to proselytize, you know, and tell everybody about it, how wonderful it is, and assume that everybody's going to go your way. And then the next part is, he called it, we laughed, it was the angry vegan, you know, when you're so upset that nobody's following your lead, you know. And
yes, right.
So we were laughing, it's like the angry vegan. Try not to be the angry vegan, you know, but sometimes the passion comes through, and it's a little bit difficult.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And you know, there's a lot of reasons to be angry. There's a lot of really bad things in the world. But it's important to recognize, you know, what our emotions are and not let anger get a hold of us. And also realize that anger doesn't generally positively influence others. And so it's sort of taking time to step back, to breathe, to recuperate think about the reaction, and then behave in a way that is going to inspire people and encourage people to make more mindful choices. And that can be small things. It can be not eating veal, for example, or trying meatless Mondays, where one day a week they try going meatless if they're not ready to go vegan. So, you know, looking for common ground, looking for small steps, and being supportive and encouraging of those small steps, and giving people tools like recipes like we have in the book, and tips about how you set up your vegan kitchen. You know, people just need to know how to do this. And part of the book's intention is to help people do this.
Are these your recipes?
One of the recipes is mine. Uh-huh. It's the scrambled tofu recipe. But there's some incredible recipes in here from some of the best vegan chefs and cookbook authors and restaurant chefs in the country. So I'm very excited for the 100 amazing vegan recipes in the book.
Yes, I have my page turned open to the greens and chickpea curry bowl, which is going to be on my dinner table tonight.
Wonderful. Love
so,
that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the worst part. I love looking at vegan cookbooks, and the pictures here are wonderful. And, you know, I like recipes with pictures because it makes you want to cook them even more. But these are so good that you just become really hungry. So I hope I can make it to get it fixed, but doesn't look that complicated. So I think I can pull that one off pretty quick this evening.
Beautiful.
So you have a lot of speaking engagements planned.
Yes. If you go to the website, which is farmsanctuary.org/living, that's a website specifically with the book, and it includes a variety of the events that I'll be at. The first one's going to be in New York City on April 6th at ABC Home. The second one's in Los Angeles on April 9th at the Skirball Center. Then on the 10th, I'm in Phoenix. On the 11th, I'm in Corte Madera near San Francisco. On the 12th, I'm in Portland. And then I'm all over the place after that. But we have a whole list of the confirmed speaking engagements on the website, and we'll be adding more as those are confirmed.
Fantastic. And people can, you can support, there's a donation page, and you can even adopt an animal if you like, right?
Absolutely. We encourage people to go to the Farm Sanctuary website, which is farmsanctuary.org. There's information there about adopting animals, about visiting Farm Sanctuary. Now that we're coming into the summertime, it's wonderful to come visit us up in Washington, New York, or at our farms out in California. And there's all kinds of information like that as well on the website.
Yeah, that sounded really, really good. I think you could deal with you being an angry vegan by just going and hugging one of your cows, right? So that'll work.
It really helps. It's a very healing place, absolutely.
That sounds, you know, I have fond memories as growing up. Friends had cattle. Of course, you know, I mean, I never really thought about what happens to their cattle, but, you know, we would go up on Sundays, and they were just kind of meander around and pick blackberries, and the cows would be there. And, you know, it was just always such a great experience. So, you know, I'm sure that this is even better when you have such a variety, and the outcome is much, much better.
Yes, no doubt.
So, so you're traveling so much and speaking so much. When's your next endurance event?
I don't have anything lined up yet until November, when I'm expecting to run the New York City Marathon.
Oh,
so
cool!
That'll be my next one. I love doing those iconic races.
Yes, it's kind of fun to run with the herd, so to speak.
Yes, indeed. A big herd in New York.
I mean, there is nothing. I did the New York City Marathon, and of course I went, you know, I got so caught up in the excitement that I'm, you know, going out running at 5K pace. And
oh my gosh.
You know, and about, you know, I looked down and my heart rate was 5K heart rate, but I felt great, you know, because I was so excited. So I kept going, and then about mile 10, it's like wasn't quite as good. And then of course about mile 14, it was not very good. And I think I phoned ahead and said, I'm not injured, but I'm in significant amount of pain, and it's going to take me a lot longer than I expected.
Yep. I'm going to have to kind of pace myself and not get too excited, especially at the beginning of that race.
Yeah.
But I've got this book tour, which is going to be a marathon of its own, and I'm just getting ready for that now.
Sounds good. So I think you should develop a line of technical, you know, kits with the Farm Sanctuary on it. How about that?
I would love that. And we haven't gotten around to it yet, but I hope we can in the near future.
And what kind of just before, I guess, a couple last questions. What the staff at the Farm Sanctuary, so you're out touring around, and, you know, who are the pet sitters?
Well, we have a staff of about 90 right now.
Wow.
And so we have people that work on the farm in New York and California, and an education staff, campaign staff, communications, development. Got a lot of great people working at Farm Sanctuary, which I feel very fortunate about.
Wow. So when you got your agriculture economics degree, was this in mind, or this just all came? I mean, what was that supposed to be about?
Well, I was a vegan when I went to Cornell, uh-huh. And the idea was to get a better understanding of factory farming and to get a sense of what the culture of that industry is like. So that's one of the main reasons I got the degree. And also, it's a nice credential to have. When I tell people I've got a master's in agricultural economics from Cornell University, it makes it a lot harder for them to dismiss what I'm saying.
Yes, very, very, very good. I would guess you had to hold your angry vegan thoughts in a lot of your courses.
Yeah, no, that's very true. It was interesting being there at Cornell where, you know, I remember one of the classes, it was an animal science class, they warned us about these animal rights activist terrorists, and I was there in the class, and they were warning us about people like me. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's like you just don't know what they look like. I'm sure you've been around in some of this with Dr. Campbell. Did you have a chance to meet him when he was at Cornell? Or?
I met him after I left Cornell, but I'm friends with him. He lives up in that area, and we've spent some time together.
That's quite an amazing story as well, you know, because, you know, again, I use his background as coming from a dairy farm, you know, because I, you know, down in Florida, a lot of people that move here from the Midwest, farming communities, and, you know, well, I was raised on the farm, or, you know, we have cattle or whatever, and, you know, so I always use him. It's like, well, you know, just because you were raised that way, and we all were raised that way, of course, you know, doesn't mean that that's the best way and the only way, so...
Exactly. We all are raised a certain way, and if it makes sense, we stay with it. But if we learn something better, we do something better.
Fantastic. Well, I know you have another engagement this evening, so I won't take up a lot more of your time, but I am enjoying the book. Like I said, I'm going to try some of the recipes, and we'll get a couple books for the office to display, and hopefully get other people to buy them, and maybe get to visit the Farm Sanctuary at some point.
Excellent. We would love for you to do that. So thank you so much for the good work you're doing there, for helping to raise awareness and helping for people to live healthier, more compassionate lives. It's a win-win-win. Good for animals, good for people, good for the earth. So thank you for being part of that, too.
And thank you for your time. Good luck to you.
All right. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview. Gene is certainly such a nice and peaceful man. I truly do believe that's a reflection of his environment and his diet. I know this was a little bit of a different interview, but his book brings everything about being plant-based all together, the health benefits, the environmental benefits, as well as the animal protection and welfare benefits. The recipes are wonderful. I've made two of them so far. I did the the greens and chickpea curry bowl. That was really good. And then last night I actually did the Palm Hearts cake, which is very similar to a crab cake, and the cashew mayonnaise on the top was really, really good. So they've both been put into my rotation as far as, you know, what I've said before, my go-to meals. So I'm looking forward to trying some other things as well as some of his dessert recipes. One thing that I learned from his cooking segment is usually when I'm doing baking or need something for thickening, I typically use applesauce as a replacement for oil. I've been also using a banana for a replacement for oil and binding things such as pancake batter and pancakes and that kind of deal. But he mentions trying canned pumpkins, so a fourth of a cup of that. So I'm going to try that in some cakes to see how that works as well. And of course, that adds a lot of nutritional beta carotene to that. So it's actually probably the healthiest option of them all. Turning to my backyard, you know, since I had the interview with Howard Jacobson and his gardening, I've started to look a little bit more into gardening, and we made wooden planter boxes. And since the last episode, we've actually got them filled. I've actually filled them with dirt, organic, of course, and I planted cucumbers, squash, zucchini, watermelon, and cantaloupe. So I'm anxious for those to start to pop up. So that's in addition to, we have some tomatoes and peppers that are doing really good, and then our cilantro and basil and rosemary plants that are doing really well. I also watched, as part of the Food Network, the documentary Open Sesame, where they talk about, you know, where our seeds come from and the loss of biodiversity and seeds, since so many of our seeds are corporately owned. A lot of the Monsanto seeds are, you know, one and done. You can't reuse or save your own seeds. So this interviews people that are part of seed banks and seed libraries, and the importance of knowing where your food comes from, not only locally, but what the seeds are, if they're hybrids, if they're GMO produced, in the plants, how much Roundup, if they were Roundup crops, because, you know, now there's pretty much some unequivocal evidence that the glycosides in the Roundup, the glycophosphates, which is an active ingredient, is probably a carcinogen, as documented by the International Agency for the Research on Cancer. And that was actually published in The Lancet. So, you know, it gives more reason to, if you can put a few plants on your back porch or have a small garden out back, especially for your greens and some of your vegetables, and especially zucchini and squash, it's going to be all the more healthy for you. The other interesting thing that I listened to was one of Dr. McGregor's pieces on nutritionfacts.org, talking about ALS and the increased prevalence. You know, it's Lou Gehrig's disease, and the mortality is very high. Currently, there's about 30,000 cases a year in the United States, and the incidence has actually gone up. It's actually reported somewhere about 1 in 400 chance of getting ALS. They looked at a population in Guam where the incidence was really high, and they found that 1 in 3 of adults died of ALS. And they started looking at why, because you know, these people lived in a remote area, and they traced it to the cycas trees, which produce a neurotoxin in their seeds. But these people only eat a small amount of these seeds. And they found out that, you know, the toxin was BMAA, and there was only a small amount. And they wondered why that they were getting the ALS. And it turns out that they eat fruit bats. And the fruit bats, they cook them in coconut milk. And the fruit bats eat a lot of seeds. So this BMAA, or beta-methylamino-alanine, is very highly concentrated in the bats that ate the seeds. Then they looked at a Canadian group of people that had the BMAA in the brains of patients that died of Alzheimer's, and they noted that this neurotoxin was found in blue-green algae. And they thought that the blue-green algae was the source of the neurotoxin. And then come to find out that in Miami, Floridians with Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson had elevated levels of BMAA. And again, it was associated with these blue-green algae that's common in the freshwater and the saltwater. And it may be from contamination, you know, in the bays and the estuaries and eating shellfish and crab and fish. So it was interesting because I've noticed that, you know, it seems like the population, you know, here in the country, people eat more fish, you know, and people come into my office, they say, well, you know, we're cutting back on red meat, but we eat a lot of fish. And, you know, the fish consumption in the U.S. has increased, but yet the Alzheimer's incidence has increased. So, you know, there may be some correlation with this blue-green algae and this BMAA toxin. But again, if you eat a plant-based diet, you're safe from this. So, you know, maybe that's another way that a plant-based diet is safe, by decreasing the toxins that's found from the blue-green algae. So anyway, I hope you get a chance to look into Gene's book that, again, is entitled Living at the Farm Sanctuary Life. It's fantastic, and like I said, the whole book is good. It ties everything together. And until next time, be plant strong and run long.